Hikki mai, kake mai. Ko mai te waiora kia hau. Kia tūtehu ana te moia, te kuia i te pō. Ka pō, ka ao, ka awatea.
Tēnā tātou katoa, nau mai, haere mai ki te Kia Whakanui a Te Whenua podcast. Welcome back. We are joining us tonight as well, Anthony Hoite and Carolyn Ho. Kia ora ihoa.
Kia ora Marcus and Anthony. And yeah, it's exciting to be here. And this evening we have got Sarah Flynn joining us. Sarah was one of our authors, and Sarah is a very well-regarded ecologist with Boffa Miskell currently, and she wrote an amazing chapter thinking about recalling the Māori of landscapes and our environments in Aotearoa. So welcome, Sarah.
Thanks very much. Kia ora, everybody. Yeah. Yes, so I'm an ecologist. My background is in plants and vegetation ecology. And I also completed a PhD on leaf mold, on decomposition of litter in pine forest, as it happens, as a model ecosystem for natural conifer broadleaf forests and native conifer broadleaf forests. And so I have a background mainly in plants, but my consultancy career, which has really been unexpectedly, I sort of expected myself to end up, well, I don't know what I expected actually when I started training. probably did not have a job actually, but as it turned out, the RMA came along, and we were all gainfully employed ever since then. And I became really at the earliest part of my career, following my graduation from my master's in 1995, and a consultant ecologist, which is really applied ecology, applied science, and that job really entails risk assessment and risk management, and that's the main part of it really. And then, you know, with forays off into, you know, developing restoration plans and things like that. But I would say if you wanted to get to the nub of what I do, it's that risk assessment, risk management as an ecologist.
Mm. Yeah. Awesome. So I think we'll just quickly go to the chapter you made. So it's called Recalling the Māori. Extremely brilliant after reading it. Like we were talking about before we pressed record, it really challenged my thinking around ecological assessments, you know, significant natural areas, and how the environmental legislation sort of contributes to what you called non-conforming ecosystems, and how it sort of limits what is ecologically significant as well. I think with that, could you just maybe speak a bit more on your chapter, if that's all good?
Sure. So I think my chapter, rereading it now, because it was a couple of years ago when I wrote it, it speaks of degree of frustration, I think. That's not right actually. Maybe an acknowledgement of the tension between the role of the job of a scientist, which is to explore concepts and to unpack them and to create them and recreate them, and then the job of a practitioner, as I said, in this kind of very focused component of the work that we do, of finding a useful way to apply ecology in a helpful way that helps us make decisions. And that decision-making process does corral us, and it needs to, into some pretty specific concepts around what is ecology, what is important about ecology, and how we should manage it. And so I was really looking for a way to create more room in that conversation for Perhaps moving us away from some of the more bureaucratic approaches that we use to being able to really prioritise individual places and being able to go and sit in these places and see what was really important about each place rather than necessarily sort of filtering it through a bunch of sort of hypothetical concepts first and making a whole lot of decisions around what was important and not important before we even looked at the place that we were looking at.
Yeah, and I guess with the places as well, like we were talking before, how everything is sort of interconnected, you know, the species, what's there, and just looking at the place itself and seeing those relationships is so important and probably gives you a more breadth of knowledge than you expect on a, if you keep zooming in on, say, a species level or, yeah, what's present, invasive species, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, no, really awesome, really, really awesome to have that view on that as well, because it's, I think a lot of things, when you assess things environmentally, it's, yeah, sort of zoned into one thing.
So,
yeah.
I think that, like, some of those concepts that we talk about, like species and ecosystems, as intuitively we understand what they mean, but in fact we have to remember that they are concepts, they're not real things, they are things that we are sort of useful compartmentalizations, but we have to remember that that's what they are. So for example, one of the challenges is when we start thinking about how we evaluate what's important about a site, we have a list of criteria that we'll apply that involve, you know, whether there, what's, how many species are present and whether any of them are rare and how many, you know, strata are present in the forest ecosystem, if it's a forest ecosystem, that kind of thing. But the notion of what a species is, as I say, is a kind of a concept, and the rarity of a species is important, but the ordinary species are also really important and often the drivers of those ecosystems. And so, you know, and you know, we also have a presumption that native species are more important in that ecosystem than the exotic species are. But in some cases, this is this reference that you made to these non-conforming ecosystems. Sometimes those non-native species are really the ecosystem drivers at that point, and they may provide habitats for really you know, valuable other species, or they may be providing a really important kind of function, biosphere function, or.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, Sarah. I found your writing really interesting with regards to the pine forest example. And it's so easy to kind of look at pine forests and go, oh, you know, this is all invasive. This is, you know, an ecological disaster for Aotearoa. But like how you described how that can actually be the kind of structure for then a whole understory of native regeneration almost doing its own thing. I found really fascinating. Do you want to talk a bit more about that?
Sure. So obviously I spent a lot of time in pine forest while I was studying. And also I've spent a lot of time in pine forest subsequently through the specific projects. So the focus of my study was on looking at the components of ecosystems and whether they function sort of independently from each other or sort of holistically. And so I went looking in pine forest to actually observe what was going on in there. And you do have these whole functioning diverse ecosystem, you know, components, you know, like understory and various processes that are happening in there. It's a bit vague, but and the other aspect to that is that they're often inhabited by lots of fauna that we put a lot of effort into conserving in other places, like In North Auckland up by Puhoi is the best population of tomtit I've seen in the Auckland region, for example, all in pine forest. Bats inhabit pine forest really frequently. Kiwi like to use pine forest. I mean, these are all sort of flagship species that are easily recognised, but I think that seeing them there, there's a kind of a, you know, there's a tendency to say, oh, well, that perhaps that's an exceptional circumstance. But what is it actually telling us? It's telling us that that forest is functioning like a forest, and we should open our eyes to that fact. The inconvenient truth about that, of course, is that the reason those forests are planted is to cut them down for as a resource. And so it's kind of, it's just from a policy framework, just too difficult to incorporate any sort of protection or priority around managing those things. So that's why we end up kind of sidestepping that issue, really, and not looking at those areas and not treating them, putting them in the same box as other kinds of ecosystems. But you know, we should call a spade, those systems function just like other more native systems do, or some version of that. You know, there is a sort of a you know, ecosystems form and have their dynamics sort of independent of any kind of clear rules of, you know, of establishment. We like to sort of think that these things are predictable and there is a sort of a right composition to them. And in fact, that's often one of the criteria that we use to evaluate ecosystems, is their representativeness. Do they sort of contain the things we expect them to contain? But even if they don't, they're still doing the thing that those natural communities are going to do. You know, they have their own dynamics.
I guess with that too, identifying just how, like you were saying with pine forests, you know, my view is that pine forests are invasive. And I guess having legislation like we have right now that sort of identifies what's good, what's not, sort of limits what people in power, or maybe those making the decisions, have, and looking at that, go, oh, okay, well, if that's a pine forest not native to Aotearoa, then it should be cut down and made way for indigenous planting as well, when in turn that's, it's not, like you said, not taking into account the ecosystem itself on the floor. And
yeah, I just jumping in there, I think that your point is well made, in a way that the it's not to say we shouldn't be aspiring to prioritize conservation and regeneration and reinstatement of native ecosystems, because our biosphere of Aotearoa is special and unique and very depleted and needs to be you know, needs to be given an opportunity to reinstate itself, and that needs human intervention. But I suppose my middle way is just to try not to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, oh, well, you know, all those exotic ecosystems are terrible, and all these native, you know, what we must do is quickly remove them all, sort of scrape them off the face of the earth and replace them with this other thing. Because what we actually find is that's really hard, and really we need a gentler approach to that. And I think in ecology, you know, as practitioners, we've learned through bitter experience, really, that process, that, you know, sort of ripping in and doing weed control for 25 years in an area may just end up growing a lot of weeds. And if you don't have a really solid plan for sort of creating that, you know, sort of reinstating a succession in a gentler way, you just end up wrecking the place. So I suppose that was what I was speaking to there.
It's so interesting, Sarah, as that kind of really leads into what your chapter was about with regards to this idea of recalling the Māori. And what does that, how do you kind of unpack that in your space, that kind of that difference, that different approach that that brings to thinking about ecology and ecosystems away from a kind of scientific compartmentalization?
And a policy compartmentalization. Again, I feel like that one of the things I talked about early in the piece was about that we think of science as a method by which we can deduce the rules of nature and, you know, make confident predictions and have deliver these concrete outcomes. Actually, science is a really creative endeavor. More than half of it, I would say, ideally, is focused on mooning about, thinking up concepts, thinking up ideas about how we think the world works, then building models, which are, you know, theories and hypotheses, you know, ideas about how what we imagine, sort of getting them into sort of constructs, and then the rigor comes with the testing of those models and the peer review of those tests, you know, the experimentation, the trial, the observation and inference, and, you know, arguing about whether you've got it right with your peers. And then you go back to refine and simplify those models. And I feel like the way we employ science in the service of resource management isn't that way. It doesn't create very much space for that reflection. And the notion of Māori creates a space for this, because instead of starting with concepts and models, starting with a set of criteria and definitions around what is an ecosystem and what is significant and what do we think is important and such like, going to those things are all concepts. They're useful, but they're not real. What's real is the place. Going and parking yourself in the place and looking around, taking the time to be in it and notice things, and notice what's actually working, not see it as a deficit of, well, there's not enough of these species here and these things are all missing, so it's not representative and doesn't tick that box, but, you know, there's a rare thing, so we can tick that box and we better make sure we manage it for the focus of that thing. That taking the time to notice what's real about, you know, what's actually working is about the place that you're in. That doesn't really lend itself to those criteria very well. There are a few sort of the vaguer criteria which talk about ecological context and
this is the RMA criteria.
The resource management. So going back a step for those who aren't embedded in resource management, RMA, in this particular question that the RMA asks of us ecologists is, what is a significant, so the RMA says that local authorities need to provide for the protection of, so they need to provide for the protection of, that's a direction, significant vegetation, indigenous vegetation, that is, indigenous vegetation, and significant habitats of indigenous fauna. So that's the protection provided for terrestrial ecosystems. And then there's also this other slightly less used and vaguer reference to supporting the life, you know, to providing for the life supporting capacity of ecosystems as well, but less well defined, and we don't
murky.
tend to end up referencing it as much. So what that does is then means that we have to define significance. And so then there are various criteria that drop out to define significance, including boiling it down to really representativeness, rarity, ecological context and pattern, and there's something else. which is again a little bit, you know, should know it off the top of my head, can't remember. So yes, often when you feel like more should be made of the place than what you're allowed by those criteria, often you find yourself kind of trying to shoehorn some of those looser ideas into, you know, or shoehorn the qualities of the site into some of those looser ideas, whereas actually just being allowed to have more focus on the place itself and first recognize those values. That to me, it just resonated with me anyway. I feel like it's a gap that we don't do as well as we might. And I would, again, how do you do that in a policy framework? Partly how we do it is make it not only about our Western concepts. Maybe that's something to hand over to mana whenua. You know, maybe kaitiaki are best place to go and evaluate the mauri of a site. And maybe then we get to take the lead from that and sort of help sort of prioritize, you know, find pathways to management for those values. Yeah.
I think just going further on that, I think a lot of what we get taught, especially even going home to Amarai and all that, is to walk the land and really sit with the land or sit in the place where you are investigating, or if it's an area of significance to Māori, then that's what we do. And you'll hear a lot of other practitioners actually say that when they do engage with mana whenua for RMA matters, most of the mana whenua groups do take them for a walk around the land. I believe when they did a concept plan of Otorohanga, they took them around the whole town of Otorohanga and basically listed out sites of significance, its significance, and just let them walk with the land and be with the land, which is exactly what you're saying, is just taking into account the big, big picture, but big picture of the whole entire place itself. So it's awesome to hear that. Mm-hmm. And it's a common practice amongst us. And I believe a lot of other, Western theories, like, I believe, is it Jane Jacobs who was the one as well to sort of tell us to walk the streets as well to see the significance and how things work within those spaces as well. So it's so interesting, super interesting.
Which is another thing that you kind of touched on, Sarah, that that kind of that holistic approach and the role that us humans have in this ecological picture as part of healthy ecosystems. That's often like quite a debated thing in terms of, you know, we're so kind of destructive, and yet there's these kind of threads of possibilities.
And we are kind of the answer. I mean, that sounds a lot of hubris, doesn't it? But we've done the damage. We need to do the fixing. Also, there is, hopefully we're getting better at this, I think, but that there is an impulse to by protect, you know, what we often take that to mean is to set aside and preserve and not go into, you know, and it kind of speaks to a, you know, fairly Western convention, I think, which is that the environment is something over there that you go and visit and then come home to your house. It's like, we're in it. And I think, you know, well, goodness, climate change and the experiences we've been having just lately with storms and floods and things, perhaps brings that message home a bit more forcefully than perhaps we've really felt previously. But I think also I'm really mindful. And so I think we all have that role to say, well, you know, what's the environment we want to live in? And I mean, one of the issues here, for example, is where we start getting get in the crosshairs of our own criteria, is that, for example, when we use these criteria to assess significance, criteria such as rarity, and then we have a major success like, Icelandia, for example, having lots of threatened birds fly off into the landscape and inhabit people's gardens. Well, that means that now people are living in the environment with threatened species. So their sites are now significant. And so what does that mean?
Because
according to all the planning and policy, that means that they're really constrained in terms of what they can do in the environment. It's not actually how it's being applied, but if you took it to the it creates all kinds of complications in terms of those rules, you know. And what does it mean to have a significant species present if a kaka comes and flies and visits your garden and then flies away?
Mm-hmm.
Is it only significant when it's there? You know, it's like it gets really hard. We have to move past these kind of compartmentalizations where we say we can set a site aside and protect that. We actually have to protect all of it. It's all significant, the whole world. We've only got this one. And we have to accept that we inhabit the world and we inhabit our environment and we do it harm, and we need to manage the harm and find ways to make sure those environments are resilient to our perturbations, and that you know, we're not doing so much that it won't bounce back. Also feel like I want to also just clarify too that the question of Māori, there's a concept that I can apply as an ecologist. I can go and use my filters, as you know, through my training and experience and understanding. It's not the same thing as, you know, mana whenua going and assessing Māori or being present in a site. You know, I'm not kaitiaki in the same way that that somebody whose place that is kaitiaki, and I can't, you know, it's I can take the concept and use it. I don't want to appropriate it or give it a new meaning. It's I just think that that's a really important distinction to draw. Mm. And we need to do both, really. We need to do both. We need to be open to applying these concepts in our own way, but also realizing that we can't take them over and say, oh, that's what this means, I'll be one of those and I can go do that. You know, it's not the same thing. Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on the RMA reforms in terms of the ecological side of things, or have you a chance to read it by any chance?
Read it, yeah. Tricky. It's a mixture. I mean, there are some things that definitely need to be done better.
Mm.
In the RMA, cumulative effect is not handled very well. You know, the idea that, you know, you can do one thing once and it's no harm, but if you do it a lot of times, it's a problem. And that was the intentions were there in the RMA, and it hasn't been captured all that well. I'm not convinced that the reforms, the approach of the reforms, which are to provide a whole lot more criteria and rules and structures around how we assess and measure those. You know, we've got, you know, they're supposedly, you know, going to develop a whole lot of indicators.
Mm.
What does that mean? I don't know how they'll find a whole lot of indicators for what is, you know, better or worse terrestrial ecology. It's actually, we've been trying to do that for ages. If they had straight answers that were easy, we would have them already, and we don't. Good luck with that, is all I can say. So, yeah, I think it's going to make us all very busy for a long time.
So I guess I had a question, Sarah, for you, and it's relating in relationship to the invasiveness, or the so-called invasion of the pine forest. And we've experienced here in Tamaki Makaurau with the Māngo Authority replacing the exotics with indigenous on some of the Māngo around the city. But of course, those exotic forests, pine forests, and I grew up in a place called Kawarau, which is a kaingaroa, and it's the second largest man-made forest in the Southern Hemisphere. And Māori have long been in forestry, and with the treaty settlements happening, Māori will soon own 50% of all exotics. And so I'm just sort of wondering, does your concept of restoring diminished Māori also apply not just to the ecosystem, but also to the economic system? Because, you know, the pine forest will provide some economic impetus for Māori through work in forestry, and particularly if we stop sending our raw logs to China and we start to process timber, particularly, again, pine, into things like cross-laminated timber, then we start to intervene in the housing. And you talk about coming to the forest and going back home. Well, actually, with things like CLT and mass engineering timber, that you know, the houses will increasingly look like forests because they'll look like solid lumps of timber. So I'm just sort of wondering if that concept of restoring diminished Māori could also be applied to, let's say, non-indigenous or the exotic forests, and also if it applies not to just ecology but also to economy as well.
Yeah. To answer one part of that question first, which is the economy relevant to decisions around ecology? And the answer is sure. That if you can move your population, your human population, to a situation where it is well resourced and stable and not living a subsistence lifestyle, then that human population has more scope to make more proactive decisions around managing and protecting. You know, you're not being reactive. You can be proactive and plan. And that's essential. That's essential for conservation the world over. And I think we've all probably quite intuitively can understand and see many examples of that. And your example of Kawarau and pine forests is a really key case in point. I know the area really well because that was one of my research areas, and I spent a lot of time in there. And in terms of the question around invasiveness, so it's really important to not demonize species, exotic species, or plants or animals, but to recognize their role, and that there's a balancing between the values that they can bring us, the good, and the impacts that they have. You know, it's how we can tolerate ourselves in the landscape, and I think it's the same about how we tolerate other things in the landscape too. And also different ecosystems, not all ecosystems are equally invasible. So, you know, tussock grassland of the high country, or, you know, the South Island is just an inherently vulnerable ecosystem because it's a low stature ecosystem. Pines are incredibly successful at living in difficult circumstances. Conifers generally are stress tolerators, and so they can live well above the tree line, and our tree line in Aotearoa, the frost line, a lot of pine species can live well above that, and they can tolerate very depleted conditions. And so there are these particular ecosystems that are really vulnerable, so we have to just be mindful of that when we put pines into the landscape. Be mindful of the places that we're putting them, and there's a new national environmental standards for forestry, which goes a little way to doing that. Not, I wouldn't say entirely the whole way that it needs to, but it's the thinking is there for that. But then you use the example of the Maunga Authority. The other thing too is that, you know, some of those trees are beautiful and are doing a lovely job of being big trees in the landscape and bringing some values. But there are other values too. Ecology is not the only value, and there are, I do, much as the idea of felling a lot of big trees can, you know, give me a little twinge, I do appreciate that there are a lot of cultural values that go along with those places, and that there are also other priorities besides just keeping those trees in the landscape. The other interesting aspect of that actually is I did do some looking into it for work, and some slightly unexpected results were that when you actually look at, for example, if you're thinking about the ecosystem in terms of where what species might be using what flora, a lot of the birds in the landscape are primarily using the shrubby understory, at least as much as the trees. And so, you know, all the lupins that are weedy all over the hillside are actually really important, you know, because they're legumes, so they're a protein source for kereru, for example. So kereru will often eat lupin foliage. It's not a tree, nobody notices it, looks weedy. You wouldn't think twice about clearing it. It's actually quite important to kereru. So so it's often the species that you miss that actually, if you pay attention, are the species that are important.
So I think we'll wrap up here. First, I just want to give a big mihi to you, Sarah. Like I said, such important kōrero, but as well as Anthony and Caroline to obviously facilitate the session as well. Yeah, I think that's us. But yeah, thank you so much for tuning in. I guess we'll see you on the next one.
This podcast was created by the Landscape Foundation.